One of the ways I think we can frame the spiritual search is the search for what's authentic. And what's authentic is intrinsic. It's not something that we should need to cultivate or add to us or try to find even. So spiritual seeking is a little bit of a misnomer. It should be spiritual recovery. Then we could be a 12-step program. But seeking out what is authentic is very difficult to do. So we need a practice to show us the difference between what's inauthentic and what's authentic, because as we begin, we don't know. In fact, if you look at the variety of practices that are available, many of them have no idea what they're doing in terms of the discovering of what's authentic. And it's a shame, because I think that there's the important guidance early on when one starts the spiritual journey that's essential in being able to motivate oneself in the right and wise direction. What's authentic? So the practice needs to have some way, some means, to recognize the difference between what's inauthentic and what's authentic. So one of the ways that Buddhism, in particular, is framed is in terms of what's impermanent and therefore inauthentic. So if something is transitory, if something is in time, temporal, then it doesn't last by definition. And then by definition, it isn't everlasting, which is the definition I'm using for what's authentic, what's intrinsic. I have tried to end this series of continua of practice to try to move each continuum from what's inauthentic to what's authentic. That's the journey, the essential journey. And along the way, to present many of the stumbling blocks, the problems, the irresolution, the questioning, the difficulties that one finds along any spiritual journey depicted in the Star Wars movies. So tonight, I want to talk about the movement from contraction, gripping, defensiveness, to love. Now, if I'm framing love to be authentic, then it must be a part of us intrinsically. And it doesn't feel obvious, not to most of us. Our desires feel obvious, our fears feel obvious, but not love, unless we understand that each of those desires and fears base themselves in love. Now, what do I mean by that? When you have light beams shining into water, there is a refraction of the light beam as it hits the surface of the water. So too, when you have an intrinsic quality of love within us, and it is filtered through the mind's distortion, if I could bring up last topic, which was from time to the timeless, when it's filtered through the time sequencing, losing its immediacy, which all authentic intrinsic qualities have, immediacy, then you get a distortion. Somewhere in there, there must be some recovery of light that just has been distorted from its original straightforward path. So if you look at desire and fan through it a little bit, you could see that there's a love for something in desire. And that the mind has contracted, remember from contraction to love, contracted around that particular goal and tries to possess it, own it. And that distortion no longer feels like love. In fact, it feels anything other than love. It feels very stressful, burdensome. It feels very poignant. It feels very sorrowful. And it feels very irresolute because you don't have the desired object. And so desire uses time in order to procure the desired object. It doesn't see the immediacy of the love, which is contained in the very expression of desire. It looks to the object that will come in time, given enough time, I hope to have the desired object. And therefore we lose the embodiment of what is actually contained within desire. Let's look at fear. How is fear love? Fear is the contracted state that wants to protect itself and therefore loves itself from what is invading it from the outside. In fact, if we saw fear as something that is genuinely on our side, it's trying to protect us. It's caring about us enough to be fearful. And if we turned it around so that we could sense the love within it and allowed us to relinquish the anxiety associated with it, which is again anxiety picked up from the distortion of time. I'm afraid of what's going to happen, not what is happening. That's always fear's message. We would sense that fear is on our side. That there was something protective about fear. Grief. Well, grief is an obvious one, I think, because it's something, some loved object that is lost. But what we're really grieving is the loss of love. Because we have again misplaced it within the objects of the world and lost the medium through which it actually, the water, the beam of light, the actual medium through which it is transpired. Because what's interesting to me is that because the mind looks out to certify itself through the objects it creates, but the medium through which those observation occurs, those observations occur, is love. And we miss the medium, but it still has a tinge. It still has a tinge of that flavor to it, even as we look out and locate different objects around us. And for instance, many of our emotions, as I just mentioned, but how we begin our spiritual journey, the love of truth, the love of contentment, the love of peace. Again, it's getting closer to an actual embrace of love itself, but it's still being tacked to an object, to an expression, to a pattern, to a display of mind. But it's a good place to start. There's still contraction around that because I'm not peaceful enough. I'm not loving enough. I'm not open enough. I'm not whatever it is that we're pursuing, truthful enough, honest enough, integritous enough, whatever it might be. And so there's this sense of diminishment or lacking in some way. But love doesn't hold that lacking. And so this, it gets completely distorted. Our lives get distorted. And so instead of really pursuing the medium, which is the most satisfying aspect of our life, the love itself, we look for the love of power or the love of possessions or the love of recognition or the love of status. We look for what love can tack itself to, what we submit love to, and then in our acquisition of that, of the enough prestige, of enough power, we think we'll have enough love. It just doesn't turn out that way, does it? You know, I was listening to public radio, and they had a survey of 20,000 pre-collegiate students, people who are just entering college. And they asked them, what did they want, gave them three choices, what did they want at the end of their 4 years? And their choices were to be a more caring person, to be a happier person, or to be accomplished in your field so that you are you gain the recognition within your field. Only 20%, and the commentator said it's the lowest percentage recorded since they've started doing this study. Only 20% of the people chose to be a caring person. That they're much more interested in the acquisition of their education to procure something like happiness, you know, but their definition of happiness, I'm sure, is related to the acquisition of things or their desires. So the first task that we have to set for ourselves is to separate out what is authentic from what is not. Now, how does the meditation do that? Because we need some practice, at least I certainly did, to sort of pick through the wheat and the chaff. Meditation does it very simply. It establishes a clarity of observation so that what we see is intrinsic. The very way we look is intrinsic. So it looks at the objects of the mind, it looks at different aspects of the mind, it looks at the emotions, and it looks at the thoughts, and it looks at the physical sensations, and it looks at different components of senses that are arising. And it does that without bringing the inauthentic to it. It doesn't bring judgment to it. It doesn't bring experience to it. Hopefully, it doesn't even bring knowledge to it. So it's trying to look, just see authentically. It's trying to see as clearly and with as much pristine awareness as it possibly can. So then you have to ask, is awareness pristine? Is awareness authentic? Well, you see, you can look at yourself and say, is being conscious authentic part of me? And most of us would say, you know, I've never been able to escape that. It is. wherever I go, I may not recognize the fact it is, but I know that there's consciousness here that's following me. And so, again, consciousness, awareness, and love must somehow be very authentically represented within the way we look. And so when we begin to look at something, if we're not looking from the background of our past, which is a distortion because it's what things were at one point, and whenever I look at what things were and try to see the way things are, there's a conflict, there's a confusion there. And so much of what we try to do in meditation is to separate out that confusion. We try to see things, even as our commentary, as our narrative, is relating to what is being seen with a background, endless caption of reactions or questions or commentary or whatever it might be. And all of this is going on. It's like a ticker tape below the picture, while we're trying to look through to the picture itself without the distortion. And it's very hard to do because we haven't learned how to do that. We've learned how to look through the caption, through the sentences, through the words, to see what we want, to see what we need, to see what is in front of us. But we haven't been able to silence that sufficiently to be able to see and not be carried away by the description. And so meditation is very tricky. It's very tricky. And we lose ourselves, and this is why it seems to take so long, we lose ourselves in the inauthentic expression of our commentary over and over and over again, never actually being able to see with any validity, with any satisfaction, what is truly authentic that's on the other side of that commentary. And we do this through a variety of different times and over a variety of different, and there are some moments when we get a clear picture of quiet consciousness and actually seeing something, and that's called an insight. When suddenly the depiction of what we have normally seen changes its perspective and we have a different view of it, a quieter view. And within this way of practicing, we become less identified with objects because we realize that the identification is just more self-asserting noise that we place on top of the object. And as we're willing to be quiet to that noise, objects take on a glow that no longer holds a possession. It's not mine anymore. Not even my emotions are mine, or my thoughts are mine. And as that begins to deepen in us, more space, we feel internally, psychically, more space. And when there's more space, there's more opportunities to see without the filter of our narrative. So it feeds upon itself. And as we begin to see free of those filters, there's a deeper satisfying contentment that is moving right along with that greater space. There's less reaction because things are not on top of each other, forcing a cause and effect, that our awareness is beginning to separate those things out. Less identification, guess what comes in? More space, guess what comes in? Kindness, naturally. Not artificially, naturally. When I'm not reacting, in that non-reactive exchange, there's kindness. Because that's what's authentic. The reaction wasn't authentic. The reaction was learned. The reaction was something I learned so that I could protect myself from whatever I thought you were going to do to me. But as I have less and less charge on you and a defense from you and a less contentment with whatever it is that's arising in me, what naturally comes bubbling up is kindness. Not just kindness, but all of the emotions which are heart-centered, like gratitude, like appreciation, like patience. Naturally. Naturally. But I want to go into this a little bit with you tonight, because I don't think we recognize that the path to kindness, to love, means stepping out of the timed reactivity that most of us live within and under. We have built up reactions to protect ourselves from life, to defend ourselves. When you say this to me, that stirs a response in me because I believe what you're saying is true. In order to defend myself from what you just called me, I react. I turn away. I do whatever is necessary so that I won't assume the label you just gave me, in action or in words. And that's why it's so quick, is because we've learned to pull our gun out, their six shooter, and have a duel very quickly. It's our way of survival. It's been dependent upon us surviving. But that is not the way of love. And as we settle our meditation within ourselves so that we begin to rest comfortably with what those messages are and learn to decipher the reactive messages in our identifying way that we look at our mind, that does not cure the pain body issues that continue to come out. But now the pain body issue doesn't have a gun to pull, because we've seen through our reactivity, but we haven't seen through the pain of our vulnerability. And so when somebody calls us a name, even though we would like to protect ourselves from it, we feel the pain of being called that name without the usual defense mechanisms that we've learned how to protect ourselves from that name calling. And so there's a moment of vulnerability there in which the name gets in. Vulnerability is the access to love. That's hard to understand, because when we think of vulnerability, we think of intimidation. We think that we are susceptible. So it's not really vulnerability that I'm speaking about, although it feels like that in the beginning. Once we've exposed these pain body issues again and again, without retaliation, without trying to force a defense mechanism forward, we begin to feel not vulnerable, but open. And there's a kind of logic that comes in. Like, we realize that whatever they're calling us is not coming from us, or it doesn't even point to us. Because as we quiet down, and as we are less involved and invested in the timing sequence of ourselves and protecting ourselves, there's also less self. There's less me that needs protection. In fact, what I was the protective mechanism that kept you from getting in too close. And once I'm beginning to step out of that, you can come in close and it doesn't scare me, and I don't need to defend you from me. And so this sense of openness begins to expand. From that state of openness, all of the heartfelt emotions begin to manifest. Again, love, kindness, generosity. These are really just different expressions of love in different situations. Generosity comes up, or appreciation comes up, or love comes up, or kindness comes up. They're basically the same thing. And so as I'm willing to expose myself more and more to the vulnerability of standing without my defenses, these natural qualities of heart start showing themselves. But guess what? If less we have looked at the pain body, the arising of our defense mechanisms, usually engendered when we were very small, we can be open, but we get our pain body just comes shooting out. It's like something that startles even us in the most sophisticated meditator. Somebody will say something and you just, there's this gripping contraction to say something back or to defend. I went to a workshop on Saturday with some of you who are here. It was with Byron Katie. I love to go hear different expressions of people who are awake. She's a very awake woman. I love, each of them have their own unique way of communicating wakefulness. Well, her style is very interesting, and I also think it's very simple, but very profound. Basically, what she does is she takes a situation, whatever that situation, it may be some reactive situation with your wife in the kitchen, which was one of the scenarios that was presented. And she has you go back to that moment in which that trauma occurred. And you're to label or to identify exactly what you said about the other person during that reaction period. And then you have to ask yourself whether what you're saying about that person is true. And when you're confronted with looking at that from a little bit of distance, psychic distance from the actual situation, you can see that, you know, it was just pain. You were just saying what pain said. You were the mouthpiece for pain. And that it wasn't true. And it wasn't true universally, and usually it wasn't even true at all because the story was incomplete. And so then she says, okay, turn it around so that you become the owner of that truth. In other words, you make me angry becomes I make myself angry. I anger myself. And as you begin to turn it around, you begin to see how much the pain body controls the disposition, the arrows of where we're pointing our cause, our causation, when actually it really is self-determined. And that all of it, the story, the reactivity, the accusation, the horror, all of it is being projected from here. And after doing that repeatedly over a number of incidences, and she said that just identify when you're reactive and then you apply this very simple process. And over doing that repeatedly over time, you begin to sense that everything that you see, say, and do is a projection. It's all projection. And it's not true. And that is her style of showing you what's authentic. Because the way we come to what's authentic is by seeing what's inauthentic. By exposing ourselves to the convoluted truths that we think, self-determined, and by questioning those deeply, by looking at them and seeing them, and really look, because it requires tremendous passion for the truth, to question our relative truth, our inauthentic truth. We want that inauthentic truth more than we want anything. It's our lifeblood to protecting our sense of self-safety, our pain body issues. What also happens through repeated episodes like that is that your pain body loses its vitality. We begin to see through it. We begin to see what it is. No longer do we throw it out haphazardly upon situations. I feel isolated and alone when I'm having to do the dishes every night. Where are you? And as we look through the storyline, and as we look through the reactions and the emotions within that storyline, we see a very different perspective of that situation and what we're calling and asking for. It's very important to understand that when we're vulnerable, when we've been accused, when we're defensive, that is the perfect situation, the perfect ingredient for the arising of our pain body. It's also the perfect storm for love to arise, because in that moment we are unprotected. And in our unprotectedness, our openness, that is the environment for love to arise. But what usually arises in place of love is a reaction to the pain body, which shoots its way through that vulnerability and tries to keep itself protected. Self-protection is the opposite of love. Not hate. Less thought, less distortion. Less distortion, less thought time, past, future. Less thought time, less I. Because I arise within that thought time reaction distortion. Less I, more love. That's the sequencing. That's the way we grow out of ourselves. There's a lot of work to do because we have to see what's truly inauthentic about how we act. We have to be willing to look clearly at what we're bringing out, what we're saying, what we're doing, what we're claiming to be true. As long as we hide behind that proclaimed truth as the truth, we have no access to love. Because self-proclaimed truth is the contraction that is the antithesis to the openness love needs. So you can't just expect yourself in meditation to sort of sit contentedly and expect there to be real, there has to be some vitality in our practice, some questioning, some inquiry. to look and to, what is that, what's going on in me at this moment? To take ourselves by the shoulders and hold ourselves firmly, accountably, to all of our projections, to all of the ways that we try to keep life out, to try to keep ourselves safely protected within. If we continue to use meditation as a way to protect ourselves inwardly from outward hostility, perceived hostility, the situation will remain pretty much as it is now for us. Pretty much a sense of separation, kind of being thrown off whenever there's a vulnerability that arises within us. Tripping frequently by claiming that we are on a spiritual path. We need to remember that the spiritual path is the discovery of what's authentic. What is part of you already? Not what are you seeking to be a part of you. Not what you are trying to cultivate as a part of you. But what's intrinsically there? Aren't we aware? Isn't that intrinsic to being alive? Within that aliveness, if it isn't formed around our contracted spirit, isn't there openness? Isn't there inclusivity? Isn't there an embrace? That's the state of what consciousness looks like when it's not contracted. That, by definition, is love. So it's available. But we have work to do, and we should never forget the cues along the way that tell us we have more work to do. And those cues are where we stumble, where we feel vulnerable, where we feel attacked, where we feel accused, the need to protect and defend, reactive. Those are the places that show us that our logic is towards the inauthentic. Our governance is moving towards the inauthentic, not towards the authentic. Love is present moment arising. It has nothing at all to do with thought/time. It's present moment arising. But we want to possess it because it's big. Love is very big. It's immense. So in order to ratchet it down so that we can claim some possession of it, we like to own it and claim, I love. This is what I love. This is who I love. I am the one loving. Make it manageable within our psyche. Build a time frame around it. I've loved you for 20 years. How could you do this to me? Which has nothing at all to do with it. It's missing the boat entirely. So many people feel like they have to protect the love they're feeling and carry it with them, romanticizing it, prolonging it, because they feel deprived of that love if they don't. And if they milk it in their memory, then they have some semblance of remembrance of it, because they forget that it's present moment arising. Anything authentic is present moment arising. Not carried in our thinking, not carried in our beliefs and in our opinions. Not self-manufactured. Always available. Always here. Always present moment arising. So I ask you, is your practice mind or heart driven? I ask you, what lives in stillness without a story? To look at the context that things are arising within, not the content of the situation. It is there that we find what we bring to, what we bring along with ourselves, within the context. But we are so used to looking at the content, the things of the world, that we miss the framing of those objects. Awareness sees, love holds, all in present moment arising. And some of us can start feeling the power of that love, and it becomes a false nirvana. We think, oh, I feel so loving. My whole body tingles with the sensation of love. In fact, I was once on a retreat where I was doing metta practice for weeks on end, and I went into a samadhi state where there was nothing but love. And I thought, oh, this is it. This is it. It wasn't it. It's not it. It's a false nirvana. And the counter influence is that we realize at some point to hold on to love is to lose love. To identify with love, to try to nurture it. How can you nurture what's authentic? It's either there or not. Test it and see if it's there. I threw down the gauntlet. Okay, I don't feel loving at all. Great. Does that mean that I'm not loving at all? I've got to be quiet enough to see if there's any love in the room besides my objection to it. Wow. There is. There always has been. Present moment arising. Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? So, as we're sitting, I'd just like to offer a few hints at discovering love now in your practice. It's not the breath, it's how you're holding the breath. It's not the attitude, it's how you're holding the attitude. It's not the emotion, it's what surrounds the emotion. Love doesn't object to any manifestation. That's what makes it authentic. Manifestation objects to love. I have none of this. Look at the context, not the forms of the moment. The way we hold the content of our minds. Okay. If you have any questions or comments that you'd like to make, I'll see what I can do with them.
I see myself practicing it's a neglect of that present moment awareness because I'm attached to this thing over here that's that I'm endowing with, you know, that is so important for me to do this, and I see myself do it.
So your mind is preoccupied with something you have to do, or?
I'm saying it's a priority.
Something, a priority. So your mind keeps going towards that priority.
It's an activity.
Or activity,
yeah.
Right? Okay, so, you know, there will be times in your meditation when that is the way, because of the pressures that are on you that are whatever that might be surmounting at that particular time. You know, sometimes you just have to let the meditation take its own drift. And if it drifts towards thought and trying to get something right in your, just let that be there, because obviously it's important enough for psychic energy to go in that direction to try to build itself, okay? And you just let it go, and from time to time just noticing where the mind is drifting and the importance that you're offering or investing in that particular thing. See if there is what's in that investment from time to time. You can actually get a sense of perhaps the pain body that's arising within that investment. Like, I have to get this right, or what will people think of me if I do something wrong in it? You can get a feeling sometimes of the fringe element or the marginal way that pain invests and keeps that reactive and that focus go, that reaction and that investment going. Sometimes it's just something important that you have to do, you know, that's in front of you to do. And
what if it's in daily life? I see myself having that neglect of the present moment. Like, the heart jumps and wants to do it, but my mind is not. I'm not protecting my heart. I'm focused on, you know, it takes hours to do this application online. My heart wants to go out, but I don't. I'm purposely neglecting that present moment awareness.
Because you have a necessity that you have to do, something you have to do.
That's what I'm saying, but I don't think it's true, though. I think that's part of that lie or that...
Do you have to do it or not? Do you have to do it or not? You just tell me.
I
just
don't have to do it at that moment, but...
You have to get it done. Yes or no?
I do.
Okay, so focus in and get it done. It doesn't have to compete. Let the mind... There's going to be times when that particular relationship to a project and everything, you just have to focus on it. It doesn't have to be you're taking your mind away from present moment reality to do this thing. It doesn't have to be a competition. You're going to give yourself over to a thorough and complete involvement in this project that needs to be done, and then you'll pick up the pieces later, okay? And as best as you can, you'll bring attention to what you're doing, but it probably won't be very successful because there's a lot going on, a lot of pressure, a lot of judgment, or a lot of other things that are going on that keeps you very focused and perhaps mildly reactive within that particular project. Every one of us in this room have many of those during the course of a day. It doesn't have to be, this is only about present moment awareness. Present moment awareness is with you in the middle of that project. From time to time, stop and see that that's true. Okay, so just like 30 minutes into it, say, wait a second here. Yeah, it's here. Hello there. Don't set up a competition with your mind and your heart. Allow your mind to be embraced by your heart. If it's in competition, that competition will create more struggle. What we're doing here is we're ending struggle. If you realize that the mind is always encased in the heart, and from time to time recognizing that fact, no matter what the mind is doing, there will be this assurance, no matter where the mind is focused, that you're carrying something along with it that's very precious. If it's this or that, your mindfulness and your awareness will be in competition with what, when the mind is engaged, and the mind needs to be engaged at many times during the day.
So if the intransigent is inauthentic, I'm struggling with the idea that life itself is intransigent. So how
intransigent or transition?
Well, I mean, life ends. Life is not, it doesn't go on forever.
So it's in transition. Yeah, okay.
So I guess I was hearing you say that anything that constantly changes
yes.
is inauthentic.
Yes, in the absolute sense, yes, it's true.
Well, life ends, and therefore...
No, life doesn't end. You end.
Okay.
Your body ends. Egoically, I hope we end. You know, your clothes get worn, you know, the body wears out. I do not believe that life ends. I know life doesn't end.
I would love to hear more about that. So I know that's another whole
topic. That was the topic tonight. Yes. The loss of love.
Loss of love or loss of a person. How does someone
right. So when you're in that state of openness, how does someone from that space deal with grief? Right? You, so it's very important here that I don't set a standard for which we need to follow, you know, that we're not somehow saying this is the way, right way to grieve. The right way to grieve is the way you grieve. What grief is, something you counted on is now missing. Okay? The process of coming to the reality that you no longer can count on that is the bereavement process. Someone who has lived very much with the fact of things moving and changing is going to usually have an easier time moving to that endpoint than someone who is held to each and every individual object with retention and resistance and having it change, you see. So you can do a lot of griefing your way through it, but it doesn't mean that there isn't going to be sorrow when someone you loved suddenly is out of your picture. And I don't think that grieving is completely absent in awake minds. In fact, the Buddha talked about the loss of his two chief disciples, Sariputra and Moggallana, as being the loss of the sun and the moon. So I just don't think what's very important in your question is that we don't set ourselves up in some kind of rigid way to try to live an awakened state prior to what is actually we're actually feeling in the moment that things are occurring. We live where we are, and we bring as much attention to it as we can. We question what's happening to us. We see how time evolves and thought prolongs. And through all of that questioning, it becomes easier to grieve. Whether grief ends or not, I don't know. It hasn't ended in me. It's become easier, but it hasn't ended in me.
I have a question related to the spiritual journey and really seeing what you talk about with the pain body and watching that happen. And this and self-improvement. I feel like I can get that confused.
confused between self-improvement and looking at the pain body, right? Okay. No, I understand. It's a very, very good question. Okay, so it's how we look is the determining factor on whether this is going to be self-improved or understood. What we're trying to do is understand the pain body, not move beyond it. Now, if you're curious and interested why this particular manifestation, presentation of psychic presentation keeps coming up to you, you'll do an inquiry. You say, what's going on in here? What's going on in here is not holding a gun to the head of the pain body and say, as soon as you show yourself, you're out of here. You're trying to understand, let me see what's going on in here. Why is this? I see that, and you feel the old memories that come back, and you see the way that those memories are confiscating the present moment attention through projection of those old memories, and you go, I got it. Now, the next time it comes up from that base level of understanding, it doesn't feel quite as powerful. And so it is changing. It's becoming less intense. But it isn't changing because you want to get rid of it. When you want to get rid of something, you're not paying attention to it. You're paying attention not to it, but to where you want it to be, which is out of here. You see? If I'm looking at how to get rid of something, I'm not really paying attention to it. I'm plotting a way to get rid of it, and therefore I'm not really giving it my full attention. What we need, what awareness is, what inquiry is paying full attention to something, and if it remains, then it remains, but at least I'll know what it is. If it doesn't remain, so be it. I still know what it is. It's the understanding that's important here, not the riddance, not the elimination. So here's the key. Are you approaching this painful subject with curiosity or with condemnation? With condemnation, it won't go away. It'll just have more reaction built within the process of your inquiry. Curiosity does not feed any more reaction into the process. Play with that. Look at that in yourself. Bring curiosity to the simplest things, like something that's difficult. You know, let me just be curious. What is this? And notice the difference and the clarity of the observation from curiosity as opposed to aversion. Okay, all. Thank you.